Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill and happy 2018. This is the first show that Jim and I are recording in 2018. I feel all new and tingly. I think part of the tingliness, Jim, that we're in the middle of a snowstorm as we record this. How's it going, Jim?
Blizzardland. Our local weather people have been coaching us about the visibility and the wind speed. And I'm sitting here looking at our front window at whiteout conditions. So if this is the last show we record, it's been a slice, Len, but
this has just been great. Yeah, you said you're down to an eighth of a tank of heating oil.
Yeah, the weather's been so terrible just getting the oil delivery to come out. So it's like, again, folks, it's been real, but if you have to chip me out of the ice, it's put me next to Walt.
For the further adventures of Jim's frozen head.
There we go.
I kind of like this on a t-shirt. I think it sounds good.
There we go.
All right, Jim, I spent part of my New Year's holiday in Disneyland. And let me tell you, it was fantastic.
Quick question. You weren't there the day they lost power for the afternoon, right?
No, they had recovered by then. That was late in December on the 30th. This was, I went on January 2nd.
So oh, okay.
There were still some fairly large crowds at DCA and Disneyland. We bought the two-park hopper. Started off in Disneyland as God intended. I think despite having just finished a really, really busy winter holiday, the park looked fantastic. All of the paint looked good. I paid particular attention on Main Street to how the maintenance is going. You know, in Disneyland, they've got arcade games and they've got little touches like working phones in the bakery where if you pick up the receiver, you can hear the party line. All of it was working. Everything worked. More importantly, though, it was the first time I'd ever seen Small World Holiday.
I know.
Yeah, in my country where I grew up, they didn't have Small World Holiday, apparently. So it was beautiful. I'm told that they just keep adding decorations to it every year. I mean, Small World is a fairly densely packed attraction with tons and tons of things to see. This was even more impressive because they had Christmas effects.
Well, and remember, that's the one that sort of plowed the road for the other seasonal overlays, the Jingle Cruise and Haunted Mansion Holiday. If it hadn't been for Kim Irvine and her team, who saw the opportunity there. For me, what's intriguing is to mix the Small World theme with other Insidious holiday songs and just to find that, oh, great, now I've got three different earworms in my head as I walk around the park.
I was paying particular attention to the transition between It's a Small World and Jingle Bells. And that seemed to go pretty well because, again, it's two songs that never end.
Yep.
We need to bring Gregory back on the show to explain that, but that was fun. Also did Haunted Mansion Holiday. That was good. The thing that I was impressed with in Disneyland was looking at how they're going to transition into the new Star Wars construction. Now, so apparently, there are going to be two different ways that you'll be able to get into Star Wars Land or Galaxy's Edge from Disneyland. One is basically walking into the park and starting a clockwise tour, walking towards up into Critter Country and past that. And that is an interesting path because not many people get all the way back into Critter Country. Let's face it. The Many Adventures of Winnie Pooh, the Winnie the Pooh ride, is not that popular in Disneyland. And in terms of restaurants, the more interesting thing is the Hungry Bear restaurant's right there. And that's a good restaurant. But that I don't know that has the capacity for Star Wars Land's crowds.
If you talk with the Galaxy's Edge design team, the layout of Disneyland actually drove the look of what is also being built in Florida. In fact, there the transition is going to be a little tougher because, face it, when you go past the Hungry Bear, there was already a pine forest there that they'd used for the backdrop. And the interesting thing is, as you transition through that forest, when you come out on the other side, you're going to find a fleet of X-Wings parked. And that's actually where they're supposedly recruiting you to go up against the Empire. But the thing for, if you do it in Florida, you go off of Grand Avenue walking past Muppet Studios into a pine forest. It's not quite going to be the smooth sort of transition that you get out in California.
But that'll be okay. I mean, they do what they can with it. I did think that in looking at the models in the Star Wars Launch Bay in Tomorrowland at Disneyland, that the layout was geared more towards Disneyland than Disney World.
Oh, definitely. Okay, I don't know if you've seen any of the more recent aerial photographer, but they are really moving along. They've gone vertical in a big, big way.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there's a fairly large tower structure in Disneyland that's visible, not quite from Fantasyland, but getting up close, you can see that there's a mast of some kind in Disneyland that's fairly well along. The other way that you'll be able to get to Galaxy's Edge is through Fantasyland. sort of like the old way you used to get to Frontierland. And that is going to be, I think, a little less woodsy in the entrance.
If you come in through the Fantasyland side, you know, through the old Big Thunder Ranch setup, this you enter a street scene and you're literally there as the Kylo Ren character and some of his stormtroopers have just landed and are beginning a search for rebels. And
okay.
That whole upper street structure there is where an elaborate stunt show is going to play out several times a day. Depending on which of these two ends you come in, you get two very different experiences. Did you make the trip up Big Thunder Way, the walkway that goes around Big Thunder, or?
Yes.
Okay, because right in the middle there is in fact a third entrance that basically drops you in the dead center of Galaxy's Edge. And
okay, there were some construction walls. Remember where the barbecue place?
Yep.
There were some walls there, and I sensed that's where the alternate entrance was going to be.
If you get dropped there, I mean, you have this sort of neutral experience, but if you walk just a street or two back there, this is where the Millennium Falcon is hidden, and that's where the piloting.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, it's just, honestly, Disney's never done a land of this size and, you know, with three different storytelling points. And that's the one thing I guess Florida won't have is that third entrance. But of course, we don't get the third entrance in Florida because that's where the extra street goes for the hotel.
Right. It's a good trade-off. I'm all for it. I think in looking at Disneyland, I would be surprised if on opening day, they let people queue in Fantasyland to get in. My sense is they will route people either all the way through Critter Country to get in because the line's going to be so long, or through the Frontierland middle that we talked about. And the reason I think that is that there would be so many people flooding Fantasyland that you wouldn't be able to get on any of the rides. And so looking at the logistics of that, I think Disneyland's going to do a one-way in, one-way out. The other thing I heard, and I wanted to know if you had heard this, while Disneyland's version might technically be finished first, they're both going to open on the same day. So if Disneyland's version gets done first, they will rent out the land or use it as a hard ticket or special event space. So both of them are going to be open to the general public on the same day, from what I understand. But if one finishes before the other, the plan is for Disneyland to hard ticket the land to make some more money. Have you heard that?
Ooh, I have not, but I will start working my trap line and making phone calls. What I was hearing out of earlier conversations is Disney World was actually quite anxious to have the Disneyland version open first because it's like, you figure out how to handle the crowds and then we'll apply the lessons. Both of them would be learning at the exact same time. That can't make people in Orlando happy. You know, there is a genuine level of fear about how do we handle these crowds.
It's definitely a concern. It was something I'd heard. I wasn't sure about it, so I figured I would ask you. The other two things that we saw, got One Last Ride on California Screaming before all of Paradise Pier gets redone into Pixar Pier. I understand that's going to be a relatively straightforward overlay.
Yeah, I mean, you are getting a sort of a pre-show scene with Edna Mode and Jack-Jack as you sort of roll out of the station. And what I love about this is that they're actually changing at least the pre-ride, the queue area. This is going to be Lentesta Land. This is mid-century modern land.
As it should be.
I just love that they're doing that sort of overhaul for that after this bare bones existence it's had since the park opened in 2001.
It was funny though, even though there was a holiday week and the crowds were still above average for it, that our wait to use it, even if we hadn't used MaxPass, was less than 20 minutes. So that was good. But the thing I liked most in DCA, we rode Guardians of the Galaxy, Mission Breakout. You know, originally I wasn't a huge fan of bringing Guardians of the Galaxy into the theme parks, especially in Hollywood Land, because I didn't think it would have fit. I've changed my opinion of it. I like the ride quite a bit. I like it actually better than Tower of Terror in DCA.
No, I felt the exact same way since this thing opened May of last year. I mean, honestly, I think it's the best thing Disney's added to the parks in like 5 years.
Yeah, the story makes sense, but I was trying to figure out why it works there. And the only thing I could come up with was that land was only so lightly themed to begin with that adding Guardians of the Galaxy doesn't really upset the apple cart in terms of theming. Sure, okay. You want to put a Guardians of the Galaxy right there? Sure. The Collector? Okay, makes sense. Why not? Right.
Well, and also when you remember that in 5 years' time, and see how they handled the Hyperion Theater during that period, because that whole land is going Marvel.
Yeah, I walked through a Bugs Land one last time and got my last photo on Heimlich's choo-choo train.
Yeah,
and that I figured that's just I'm not going to see it again.
Well, so. Supposedly Flick's Flyer is the one thing that's going to survive, though that's going to go down toward the end of the Incredicoaster, and that's going to be rethemed around Inside Out.
That's kind of funny, actually. I like it. All right.
My understanding is they're going to warehouse some of this stuff for a while. There's going to be a pause after they get Pixar Pier up and running as they determine whether or not they want to continue to march it up the street toward Mermaid. And whether that means, in fact, that Goofy Sky School or we see some other Pixar characters brought in to make this a full land, because that's the Imagineers' response to Galaxy's Edge. They just feel that when you're turning people away from Disneyland at 10 o'clock in the morning, and that is the, yeah, honestly, the genuine fear.
Oh, it totally happened. It's completely going
to
happen.
Yeah. So it's just like you have to have IP that people really are excited about. Disney's way of thinking, so we got Star Wars in Disneyland, guts up Pixar's presence in a big way, and DCA, likewise Marvel. And that's the next 5 years. My understanding is Bugs Land will hang in there in its current form till right after the holidays of 2018. And then January, yeah, 2019, construction goes, walls go up, and that gets flattened, mostly because, again, you know, the pivot at that point will be promoting heavily, come to Batuu, go experience Galaxy's Edge. And hopefully by then, also on the heels of the opening of Pixar Pier, we'll get more details about the Marvel Land expansion for the Hollywood Studios backlot area.
Got it. So that was my trip. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was glad to see it. The food was good. The people were good. Everyone was super friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And everything looked like it was working. So good trip, all in all.
Did you get down into Downtown Disney at all? Because I guess the cinema, Rainforest Cafe, you know, all of that starts to go away, what, now?
I barely walked through the thing that we were coming in from off-site. The thing that we noticed was that there was still not a great way to enter the park,
mm-hmm,
if you were coming from off-site.
Yeah, and that's honestly going to get tougher with the construction of the new parking garage. Just talking with friends here in Anaheim, the survey markers are up all over property out ahead of the construction. And I just...
Are they really?
I cannot imagine what it's going to be like getting in and out of that garage this summer, what with the second giant parking garage being built right next to Mickey and Friends. So
yeah, we'll see. But like I said, the park looked really good. I was very happy with it.
Okay. Changing the subject here. Now, so you're out in California, so you haven't yet made it to Florida, right?
Not yet. Going in a few days.
I'm going to genuinely be intrigued to hear your thoughts about the new Hall of Presidents, which, again, I'm embarrassed. We did our year-end show, our looking back at 2017, and didn't mention that on December 19th, in a relatively quiet way, Disney reopened the Hall of Presidents with the Donald Trump AA figure doing the now standard speech of the seated president. And I've been talking with friends at Imagineering, and it's fascinating that nobody wants to step up and take credit for the changes in the show. I mean, normally when you make...
Yeah, normally Disney walks out an Imagineer, yep, who, you know, who worked on it, mm-hmm, and they talk about their inspiration for it, what they were going for, how much fun it was to work with it. Yeah, there was a lot, right?
Mm-hmm. And this just dead silence. Nobody wants to talk. I mean, and the interesting thing is if you watch the show online, there were a ridiculous amount of changes made to this thing.
Right.
And to be honest, I kind of found it unfair that the media sort of fell like wolves on the Trump likeness, because let's be completely honest, if you look at the Obama figure up close, that likeness really doesn't hold.
It doesn't. I don't think the President Obama figure looked especially like President Obama. But that said, mm-hmm, the Trump AA figure is hideous. Let's call it what it is. Did you see Madame Tussauds Wax Museum's tweet,
yeah,
about it? For our listeners, there's a meme, a popular meme, mm-hmm, meme. It was at the end of the year. It was me at the beginning of 2017 versus me at the end of 2017. And the idea is you have these sort of before and after photos. Madame Tussauds actually tweeted out a picture of Donald Trump during the inauguration as their me at the beginning of 2017. And at the end, they used a close-up of the Hall of Presidents animatronic face, which, again, is not very good.
Well, Len, just to clarify here, the picture they use, that's their Trump figure.
Oh, they use their Trump figure. Oh, okay. Even funnier now.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's the thing. That I got to interview the woman who's in charge of the figures for the Orlando, the Madame Tussauds, it's on iDrive.
Oh, really?
And yeah, they actually had a whole binder on Trump, and every week they take the head off the figure and take it out back and restyle the hair because it is such a distinct hairstyle, and they really value, they want that killer likeness, and wax is a malleable substance.
Right.
Talking with folks on Imagineering, though, they push back, and it's like, look, if you want to be completely honest, since 93, you know, when we started having the president's talk, you know, when we had Clinton talk, and the Clinton likeness, if you double back on that and look at the video that's out there, the Clinton likeness isn't all that great. The Bush likeness isn't all that great. But the argument always is like, look, this show isn't a close-up. This show is a tableau. You're supposed to stand back 300 feet, and it's seeing all of these chief executives gather together on stage, and that, you know, you're not supposed to be 6 inches away from Trump's face. You're supposed to be 60, you know, 70 feet back and taking the sweep of the show. That said, flat out had Imagineers tell me they weren't real thrilled with the audio they got back from the White House. But again, he gave them 20 minutes to record this.
Yeah.
He read it quickly and then just like, all right, you know, I think they got two takes out of him. They wanted three, but it's like, he's the president. You get the time, you get the time.
Yeah.
And this is what they could do with that audio. And part of the problem is that we've seen Trump on television every day. We've seen Trump on television for years. And with a figure that it's basically nailed to the floor. I got this full dissertation about he talks with his chin thrust out. He constantly, and that our A figures are not built for chin talk.
Oh, okay. I can see that then as a possible explanation for why the face looks the way it does.
But anyway, long story short, Imagineering had a very blue Christmas, largely because this is the first time ever that they've added something to the Hall of Presidents and just been hammered by the media.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Seth Meyers, by the way, who is no fan of Donald Trump, mm-hmm. is using Disney's Hall of Presidents face for Donald Trump as the caricature in his nightly news. So that's the standard face now of Donald Trump on Seth Meyers' show. All the late night comedians did a bit on it. Many did it for a couple of days. I got to say, it's not the best work that Disney's ever done. I mean, even go so far as to say it's not appropriate for the president. That's something that needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
Take it down now, and it's like conspiracy, but yeah.
Oh, no, that's whatever. Speaking of which, I did want to point something out. There was a lot of talk about how it took Disney 11 months to get the Hall of Presidents back up and running again. And you and I talked about the fact that they seem to be dragging their feet this time. But it's worth noting, though, that when they brought the Barack Obama figure in, they closed the Hall of Presidents out ahead of the election in 2008. It actually closed on Halloween night. And it wasn't until July 1st of 2009 that the show came back up again. So that was 8 months versus 11 months. So,
all right. Close enough.
I just feel bad for the Imagineers to have all of the night comedians going to sort of fall on it. It's not been a happy time for Imagineering.
You think they'll pull it down during a refurbishment and redo the face?
It's one thing to have the mainstream media and you know, the press kind of teasing and making fun.
You're really going to use the phrase mainstream media, Jim?
Well,
really?
Well, I mean, Disney knows it's an easy target.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, it's easy to take pot shots at Disney for it. I do think, and I say this as no particular fan of the president, mm-hmm. the face is not appropriate.
Just chatting with the folks, it's like, in profile, it works.
I didn't check that.
But at the same time, it's like, boy, you know, you get them talking and this just can of worms opens up.
Yeah, they're kind of in a pickle now if they do pull it out, right? If they do redo it, because if they take the attraction down, then they're basically admitting that the first one wasn't good. There's just a lot that, yeah, I get it. I mean, they are in a pickle. What are you going to do?
One final thing here, though. One of the reasons that they have a problem with the figure is the president loves to be artificially tanned.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is when they initially put him in, you know, with his actual in real life skin tone, and put him up.
He looked like the second black president.
It was unfortunate. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why the face doesn't work, is that a lot of the coloration that we associate with Trump just isn't there. And that coloration covers a lot of sins. You know, this is a 70-year-old man we're talking about.
Right.
So that was the thing. When you scraped off all the makeup and the bronzer, it's just like, whoa. But then he at least fit the color palette of all the other presidents. In fact, that's the other reason he's not wearing his signature red tie.
Oh, really?
When they put him up on stage with that, it was like the combination of the bronze face and the red tie, and it's like, whoa. So we have 44 chief executives and a parade float from Macy's. And it's just sort of like, crap. Okay, back up the truck, lose the tie, lower the color palette, and then you had this face that didn't look like his face.
I mean, there are technical reasons. So there's combine the technical reason with the animatronic,
yeah,
and the way that he the speaking style with the coloration stuff. I can kind of see it. If this is the worst thing that happens, you know, the Hall of Presidents over the next 4 years, you know, so be it. That's fine.
Oh, one other final thing that was mentioned about the update was that supposedly they put these metal pieces in to prevent people from charging the stage and doing God knows what. It's like,
oh, really?
Yeah. See, it turns out those have been there since the 70s, you know, just, it's one of these things where it's like, I couldn't get them to confirm that they'd been put in because of Nixon. One of these things where it's like, no, those have been there forever. If that isn't a, we're putting in Trump, put up the barbed wire fence. Again, I apologize, you know, just only after we finished recording the show, it's like, we didn't talk about Trump. We mentioned the entire year of 2017 and somehow overlooked the AA figure. So,
oh, that's funny.
So there you go. And speaking of things we finally get around to today, we're going to do it, Len. We're going to finish the Spectrum Magic story.
All right. So, Jim, let's talk about this. This is part three of our Spectrum Magic show. Where did we leave off last year when we were talking about
this? I think at this point, we need to talk about the gentleman who's most closely associated with the show, and that's Don Dorsey. He's credited as the music designer of the Main Street Electrical Parade, and for a time, Don was in charge of the Spectrum Magic Project back when it was called the Electromagic Project.
Okay.
Don's listed the music designer of the Main Street Electrical Parade, but given that he didn't start at Disney till 75, he couldn't have worked on the original iteration, which ran at Disneyland from 72 to 74. But he was heavily involved in the second generation of the parade, which that debuted in 77, right after American Parade went away, and at both Disneyland and Disney World. And given how well that version, and this is the one where they went from the flat two-dimensional parade floats to fully dimensional, and Don then becomes the guy at Disney World when it comes to nighttime spectacular. So if you saw Laserphonic Fantasy at Epcot, or Illuminations, or Reflection of Earth, or Sorcery in the Sky at Disney MGM, you have Don Dorsey to thank.
No.
So now when it comes time to replace the Main Street Electrical Parade, given that Disney World's Magic Kingdom was built at a bigger scale than Disneyland Park out in Anaheim, that Don's thinking was that if we're doing a new nighttime parade specifically designed for this particular theme park, he wanted to seriously up the scale. And so I've got a quote here from an interview that Rick West did with Don for his late great Theme Park Adventures magazine. And this talks about the initial development of Walt Disney World's Electromagic Parade. Again, not Spectromagic. And Don talked about the thing that I insisted on from the beginning is that we shouldn't repeat what we'd previously done with the Main Street Electrical Parade. This time around, we didn't want to have small units like a single dragon or a single funhouse face or that sort of thing. I wanted large units like Cinderella and Alice in Wonderland's theme sections made up of multiple floats that would then fill up an entire street. So when you did something like that, you'd be able to do one musical idea, but it could last more than a minute. He also wanted each of these the units that were in Electromagic to undergo some sort of a transformation, take advantage of all these new technologies we had at our disposal. So Sleeping Beauty Garden unit, that would go from day to night. The Fantasia unit would unfold and reveal Chernabog, and the finale would go from sparkling silver to all rainbow colors that would wash starting on the first float all the way back to the back. Folks may remember from the finale of this parade, there was a carousel. And that Don actually talked about how that was one of his bigger disappointments, because he said, we've never done anything like that. We've never put a carousel on a float and had it revolve and give that sort of kinetic. It's like a carousel could be fun. We could have characters riding it. And the design and construction team said, well, it would have to be tiny because in order to sit and float, it could only be 6 feet across. And so Don goes, well, does it have to be round? We could make it rectangular and do sort of a forced perspective squash carousel. And so the engineering guys, yeah, I guess we could do that. And so it was a challenge, and in the end it worked, but it only ran for the first 10 days of the parade.
Wow, 10 days?
Yeah, he said during the first week that when the parade was running, it broke, and they never bothered to fix it. They had other problems with the parade that became higher priorities, and by the time that they circled around to, we should fix the carousel, it was like, we have no money. And it will have to stay that way. And I can tell you, having been there for the opening night performance, it was impressive. I mean, it did exactly what Don hoped. It added a certain level of kinetics to the finale of the parade. But where it got interesting is that Don genuinely believed that he wanted there to be some continuity between, again, Electromagic and the Main Street Electrical Parade. And he fought to keep Baroque Hoedown as the theme. And he said, and they voted me out on that. They literally took him off the project because it was, you know, just sort of like, nah, that's an old-fashioned idea. And if you're going to fight for that, we don't want you to be part of this parade. So,
wow. So the hill that he chose to die on was Baroque Hoedown.
But he was right. When Light Magic opened at Disneyland in 1997, and that parade had a brand new score that was written. But midway through that parade, they suddenly do a reprise of Baroque Hoedown. Every night when that happened, the crowds would cheer.
Funny.
If you watch Paint the Night at Disneyland Park now, that parade's transitioning over to DCA for the summer of 2018. But when that parade quotes Baroque Hoedown, people do go nuts. That there's something about that piece of music that Disney fans particularly just love, and he was on the money there. Which isn't to say that Spectromagic didn't have a wonderful score. I mean, John actually has done a lot of work for Disney over the years. He did the music for Emperor's New Groove in 2000, Chicken Little 2005, Hannah Montana movie in 2009. He was behind the music for Jon Favreau's Jungle Book in 2016, and his work is out in theaters right now. He's the guy who did the music for 20th Century Fox, The Greatest Showman, the P.T. Barnum thing. But back in the early 90s, he had this amazing window at Disney where he first did Phantom Manor, the score for that, but on the heels of that, he did Hocus Pocus, the film for Disney, and then he gets tapped to do Spectromagic and records this first time ever Disney had done a parade song in three-quarter time, but he gets a 70-piece orchestra and gets this amazing, rich score. The theme song for it, On This Magic Night, he wrote with Steve Scorgia. And John actually talked about how we kind of woodshopped that together. He wrote the lyrics. I kind of wrote the song around the lyrics, and who knew that it would play so long? And also, the whole time Len and I have been recording the series, I have been hammered with emails from listeners who all they can think of when they hear about Spectromagic, they want to talk about the Spectromen.
I was going to say, let's talk. I was going to say that for the end. Okay, let's talk about the Spectromen.
Okay, the story that the design team came up with for the Spectromen is that these are the characters who supposedly create the power that powers the Spectromagic Parade. So the really for real backstory for this parade is that the Spectromen are keepers of light who come from the land of Lightspiration. And it was Mickey's suggestion that they join him and the other characters in the parade. And they initially had a little stage fright, but they finally work up the courage to accept the offer. And if you can believe it, they have names, Len.
What year was this?
This was 1991.
Okay, and I was young then, but drugs were still illegal in the United States in 1991,
right? Oh, I don't know about that, Len, when you listen to these names.
apparently not in certain parts of Florida.
Yeah,
okay, go ahead.
All right. The four characters on the light balls, the little Spectro Man who rode, one was called Hyper Chic.
This was someone's job to write this.
There we go. We have Lowball, Rapper, Lowball, yes. And finally, the final character was called Opera.
Lowball, Rapper, Opera.
And Hyper Chic.
Hyper Chic.
All right. So the first iteration of the parade, they wore masks that were the luminous plastic that were lit from within. And people found them so disturbing that when the parade actually shut down in the late 90s for a year or two, when the characters came back, they had new faces that were a little less nightmarish and a little lit from below.
Oh, so these were like clown masks lit from below.
Yeah. There were a couple of different configurations. The Spectrum Men parade used to start off with two of them on whirly balls, and then there were the Spectrum Men trumpeters. Mickey then came rolling on stage and with his Spectro Magical cape. And then you had the Spectro Magic title float, which for a lot of years Disney diehards enjoyed because it had the original Disney World logo on it. And it, in fact, that disappeared probably in year 92, 93. But this was the one place in the park where you could see the original font and all that sort of thing.
Oh, I'm looking at photos of the Spectro Men, Jim. And yeah, it's like the masks are Venetian carnival masks?
Yes.
But with that creepy clown vibe?
Yeah.
Oh.
They also would say these nonsensical phrases. In fact, that's what we've got most of our mail about, Len. It's like, what were they saying? For years, I watch this parade and it would lean in toward the parade to try to figure out what they're saying. And they're basically saying zoom. Yeah, zoom, 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 zoom.
I think they're saying Zool from Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters.
Yeah, these were not child-friendly costumes.
No, they were not.
Huh.
And they played with various different configurations. So the parade initially runs from October 1st, 1991 through May of 1999. And then the Main Street Electrical Parade returns for the start of the Millennium Celebration. That was, you know, sort of a special treat. Sure. Spectro then comes back in March of 2001. And then continues for another 9 years, finally ending its run in 2010. And strictly from a stats point of view, it was an amazing achievement. We're talking 600,000 lights, what was 100 miles of fiber optic cable at that point. And one of the reasons that people today still talk about the music for this thing is that there were 204 speakers buried on all these floats. You know, so you got this amazing sound. And there were people within the company who loved the show. It's worth noting that in Paint the Night, if you hang in there for the end unit, you get the whirly balls. Only instead of the Spectro Men riding them this time, you get Goofy, Pluto, and Donald. At one point, there was, in fact, a plan that Spectro, like Main Street Electrical Parade, was going to march around the world. It was going to become the replacement parade at all the parks.
We hear this all the time, though, with Disney parades, that they're going to be shared in different parks around the world. And we seem to get the same couple of parades recycled among the domestic parks.
Well, in this situation, let's remember, I mean, this thing opens October of 1991. April of 1992, Euro Disney opens. And almost immediately, the financial drag that causes disrupts so many plans that the company had. And so the plan to create a Spectro for Anaheim and a plan to eventually create a Spectro for Paris all fall off the table. And that wasn't the only thing that got tripped up by Disneyland Paris, $3 billion. You know, Westcott, which I promise folks, once we start up our chronological Disneyland thing, you know, just like we just now finishing the Spectro Magic story, we will finish the Westcott story and then start to march toward talking about how we got California Adventure. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, how that park will be changing significantly over the next 5 years.
Oh, it definitely will. So, Jim, the Spectro Magic, when it ended, we know it's not coming back because the parade floats were definitely destroyed, right? Is that true?
Yeah. You know, and the interesting thing is that they were parked out back for quite some time. And for a number of the marathons and that sort of thing, when they'd run you backstage, I guess the units that survived with the least amount of work were from the Ariel's undersea portion of it, especially the Russian nesting doll versions of the fish floats.
Right.
They were parked out there for years and years. But yeah, eventually the guys who were working the parade barns, it's like, look, these are taking up space, especially with the Main Street Electrical Parade floats being as old as they were, needing as much maintenance as they did. It's like, look, these are the ones that need to be undercover, and these are the ones that we need to do the most work on, and you're not using this parade anymore. And I guess there were, in fact, conversations about well, maybe we could send this to Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. But that never happened. And yes, eventually they all got trashed and thrown in a dumpster. And the interesting thing is that Disney did not want the collectors to get a hold of these things. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, it's kind of like what happened with the subs for 20,000 Leagues, that the notion of Disney saved two or three, but in the end, you know, they basically trashed the whole fleet. So I'm always amazed that these outfits that sell Disney theme park memorabilia, it's like, you trashed them. Why are they still selling the windows and the seats? And it's like, well, we allowed people to climb in and out of the dumpsters, and they were determined with Spectro they wouldn't allow that to happen. So
Okay. So that's why there's not a lot left of the
Yeah.
Of the parade. But it's definitely not coming back, right?
For those people who were horrified of the Spectro Men, yes, we can assure them they're not coming back. The lit masks are somewhere 6 feet down in a, you know, a landfill at this point. Remember, a lot of, you know, Friday the 13th movies end that exact same way. And
exactly. So we're one lightning strike at the landfill away from Spectro Men returning, is what I'm hearing from this. If
we know there we go.
About horror movies. That's exactly what it is.
Sweet dreams, folks. Okay. You know,
exactly. I'm going to post some of these photos with the show. It's terrifying. Yeah. It's terrifying. All right. So, Jim, we'll pick up on the next show with our chronological Disneyland.
There we go.
All right, folks. That's going to do it for us on this episode. Don't forget, we are produced fabulously by Aaron Adams. Please go on to iTunes, Stitcher, or, you know, your local garbage dump where you can find many of our shows. And tell us what you would like to hear next and rate our show. For Jim, this is Len. We'll see you on that next show.